Welcome to Alpha Trader. I'm Aaron Task, along with Stephen Alfer, and we have a really big show this week. Coming up, Dan David, the founder of Wolfpack Research and activist short seller. You might remember him from the China Hustle. But first, our guest now is not a short seller by nature, but he is short. We're pleased to welcome back Mark Minervini. He's the author of several best-selling books, including Trade Like a Stock Market Wizard and Think and Trade Like a Champion. He was the U.S. Investment Champion winner in 1997 and is leading the pack this year in the $1 million plus money manager category, up 262% through August. He's also the founder of Minervini Private Access, an online educational platform. Mark, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Hey, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. As I mentioned in passing there, you on September 13th tweeted out that you are shorting the SPY into strength, tight stops at new highs, very low risk trade. And then in the last 24 hours, you reiterated that we are still short from 913. As I've maintained, risk remains high. That's a quote from your tweet. Now, we are talking late morning on Tuesday, and major averages are up 1% plus, rebounding from recent weakness. Is it fair to say that you don't believe in this bounce here?
Well, as a matter of whether I believe it or not, it's just a matter of, you know, managing the position. So I shorted on 913 and the position's been profitable. So we've moved our stop down to a break even. So I'm what I call free rolling now. So it's either I make more money or I lose nothing. So it's I'm in a good position right now. Once you get it at a profit, of course, you have some options open up to you. So but I'm playing this as sort of an all or nothing bet. Either I'm going to be really right or I'm going to just break even on it. And it's going to be a nothing gain, nothing loss trade.
And so what would really right look like for you? Because you recently, another tweet you recently put out that caught a lot of people's attention. You wrote, with the NASDAQ on a dicey foundation of only 35% of stocks above their 200-day during a seasonally volatile period, I have to respect the recent pattern of consecutive distribution days on heavier and heavier volume while persistently oversold. Similar action led up to the 87 crash. Now, anytime anybody mentions the 87 crash, you know, that definitely raises alarm bells and get people's attention. How high of a risk do you think we are for another event of that kind of magnitude?
An event of that magnitude is extremely unlikely, but I treat every time the market comes under selling pressure and things start breaking down, you know, I'm smart enough to know that I'm not smart enough to know. So, you know, in 87, everybody, you know, thought that there was no way the market was going to melt down also. You can go back and look at every meltdown that's ever happened. And I assure you the sentiment prior to it was that, you know, they didn't think a meltdown was going to happen. That's why there are meltdowns. The chances of that happening are very low. And I know when you mention that, it's like all of a sudden everybody thinks I'm calling for a crash. No, I'm just saying the market is correction prone and we don't know how far it's going to go down. So I'm going to stay short until the weight of evidence shifts and shows me that a reliable bottom has been established.
And how do you, mechanically, how do you short? Do you short individual stocks? Are you short futures, short ETF?
I'm short the S&P right now via the SPY. So I actually shorted the ETF. There are reverse products that you can actually go long that you would be short. I'm an old school guy. So when I'm short, I like to be short.
You said you're kind of like all or nothing, but do you have any kind, do you buy like, let's say out of the money call options on the chance that maybe there's a big bounce?
I personally, I don't trade options, or I'm not going to hedge that way. I'm in a directional bet right now, and like I said, if this were to melt, the market was to, you know, really exacerbate itself to the downside, I'd probably, you know, cover right into it. If it goes against me right now, I'm at a break even, so I'm not at any risk of losing any money at this point.
Certainly, the 87 crash, but other sizable declines as well, often seem to be accompanied by tighter monetary policy. And while the Fed is kind of talking about that right now, I don't think tighter monetary policy is actually on the table. Does that, you know, kind of affect your thinking at all?
Well, I thought the Fed news of tapering sooner than expected was shrugged off a little bit too easily. And then, of course, it looks like we got a little bit of a hangover after that and the market started, you know, coming in a bit here. But as much as I sound like this bearish person being short, I think we're still in a bull market, and I think that any pullbacks right now would be a correction within an ongoing bull market. So I think it's going to present a buying opportunity. So longer term, I'm not bearish as far as saying the bull market is over and a major bear market starting. I just think that we've gotten ahead of ourselves. The ice has been thinning a bit, and that, you know, we're correction prone at this point. And we're already pulling back here. It's just a matter of how much now, because a lot of stocks have already corrected. 80% of the S&P 500 stocks are already down 10% or more.
Right. I'm glad you made that distinction between, you know, calling for a bear market or, you know, a correction within a bull market. You were recently on IBD's podcast, and you referenced the similarities between what's happening now to 2018, when the S&P kept hitting major support levels, rebounding, and then rolling over amid a lack of volatility. And you said, quote, eventually you have to pay the piper in that kind of environment.
Yeah.
Are we there right now? I mean, is this the paying the piper moment? Or, well, you're still short, so I think you think things could get worse. But again, let's go back to that 2018 analogy. What do you see as the similarities, and what might be the differences?
Well, I think this is really important to focus on a few differences, because first of all, in 18, we had an incredible amount of froth and sentiment was really, really bullish. We also got extended. We ran up and got very extended in the indexes, and a lot of stocks were extended. Right now, we've got a lot of stocks that have already corrected, and sentiment is actually pretty reasonable right now. So again, I think if we sell off from here, it'll probably put in a low fairly quickly, and it'll be a buying opportunity at some point. So while there are some similarities, I think it's definitely a different setup right now.
Okay. And how much do you pay attention to or care about seasonality factors? I mean, why is it that all this kind of stuff seems to always happen in the September, October timeframe? And we mentioned the 87 crash. Of course, major crashes have occurred historically in October, but it's also been a month where major lows have been put in for the market.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is a seasonally weak period right now. Going back, looking at cycle work, we should have topped around in mid-August and then have trouble going into this next, you know, month or two. And you know, I recently quoted my friend Kevin Martyr said, you know, when you're in this business long enough, you learn to respect that October period. And there's been a lot of melt, you know, I've been short and been calling for meltdowns for a couple decades now. The October in 98 was one that was similar comments to what I did just recently, and we had a pretty good, you know, decline. At the time it was 500 over 500 points, which was a, you know, pretty big percentage considering where the Dow was at that time.
You mentioned obviously that you're short the SPY. Mm-hmm. Are you long anything here? Because, you know, energy stocks are ripping, you know, along with commodity mm-hmm. prices too. Or are you just a one-way bet kind of trade right now?
Yeah, just long a couple stocks, but mainly and mostly cash. Short, of course, net short, but on a little bit of Tesla. And there's a small company, symbol CYTK, that bought recently. I bought it in September and still own that. So really, but pretty much all cash and net short.
What was the stock that you said you bought?
CYTK, and we own some Tesla.
Okay,
Psychokinetics. Yeah.
We're up about, I think we're up about 12-13% on it. So we're out of profit there. So at this point, you know, it's acting pretty well. But you know, again, nothing to really to speak. I'm not looking to buy, you know, stocks aggressively right now until, you know, I see signs that we've got a bottom here.
And what would those signs be of a bottom?
Would see stocks mainly, you know, to see stocks setting up and having stocks that meet my criteria. I'm always looking bottoms up. So, you know, just like even on the downside here, one of the reasons why I got negative on the market, and I think you referenced this before, is because we've seen the percentage of stocks in the NASDAQ go from over 80% to only 35% of the percentage of stocks that are above their 200-day moving average. Mm-hmm. So, and when we were having the market, the NASDAQ hitting new highs, while you had that, you know, divergence, and I've been pointing this out for months now, that usually is an ominous event that leads to a correction. The market indexes usually catch up to what those stocks are saying. So just like that, on the opposite side, I'd want to see stocks starting to act better, and that would lead me to getting back into individual equities.
Okay, so that's really interesting. The averages could continue to struggle, but you would look kind of look below the surface, and you see, hey, you know, there are no longer so many stocks, but beneath their 200-day moving average or making new lows. And even as everybody's kind of panicking that indexes kind of be falling, you might start getting long.
Yeah, I'm always looking beneath the surface. I'm always looking at the individual stocks. That's really my expertise, is you know, gauging and analyzing those individual names. And that leads me to being long or short in the market. And you know, while I have made a lot of, you know, great market calls, you know, going all the way back to the early 90s, they really haven't been by looking at the market, if you know, the indexes, as much as I'm just getting a read of what's going on with all the individual stocks.
Right. It's interesting. You were here on May 6th, and you talked at that time about that there were a lot of stocks. They were, looked like they were building bases. They would break out, but then they would come back in. And you said they called it a squat position, where they have a reversal and a lot of wiggles.
Yeah.
And so how, I mean, I know this is a, I'm not asking you for the secret sauce, but how are you up 262% in the U.S. investment champion contest? In this kind of environment where it sounds like for most of the year, it hasn't been easy sledding.
Yeah. Well, if you go back to May 6th, I mean, you'll see there's a period from that point. It was almost, almost pinpoint where the market started taking off as far as the NASDAQ's concerned. And it made a pretty good rally from there. Sure. You know, it depending, this has been a very bifurcated market. I mean, depending, the NASDAQ went up about 10% from there. So depending on what you're looking at, the Russell 2000 has been moving sideways since January. So again, it's been a very bifurcated market, but there has been an opportunity that I pointed out very early on, probably around February. I talked about it on Twitter, and it was this window of having a lot of stocks emerging and moving and breaking out, but only going up for a number of days, maybe 1, 2, 3, even 4 or 5 days. So there's a lot of trading opportunities. And that's what makes, I think, this market pretty unique, is that as much as it's been difficult, there has been a lot of short-term trading opportunities. So I've been taking advantage of that and just sort of shortened my time frame and been just compounding a lot of small moves.
So I mentioned that you know, founder of Minervini Private Access, and your annual master trading program is coming in mid-November for our listeners who might be interested. You've got some big name guests, you know, other market wizards like David Ryan and Larry Hight, Tom Basso, among others. Yep. What, and I know you're not here to promote this, but you know, what should people expect from that? What are you going to get from there?
Well, it's my trading methodology A to Z, and it's 4 days of curriculum, a couple of days of special guest, a day of Q&A, and then an entire day of live trading. So it's a really A to Z all encompassing. You get a 500-page workbook. So it's if you want to learn what I do, this is the ultimate opportunity. So we do it once a year, and it's been a great success for 12 years, and I'm very proud of the program. So this year is really special because we also have Stan Weinstein. So it's and Mark Ritchie, of you probably read in Momentum Masters. So yeah, it's a real all-star lineup this year.
Right. And again, this is not a paid promotion, but if you go to minervini.com, you can find out more about that for our listeners who might be interested. And so not to give anything away, but you recently tweeted out, you know, your top trading rules. And, you know, I wanted to talk about a couple of them.
Sure.
You said never risk more than you expect to gain, which I don't know why that surprised me, because it seems like, so when you go into a position, you have a defined gain that you're expecting as well.
Nope, it's just the opposite. I have a defined risk.
Okay.
And the risk is based on how much I can expect to gain. So it's like, you know, think about it in poker terms. You know, you wouldn't want to bet $500 into a $50 pot. You'd be laying 10 to 1. But if you had a $500 pot and you bet $50 into a $500 pot, you'd be getting 10 to 1. So the real goal is in trading is no different than any other speculation. You want to always be getting odds on your money.
Got it. Okay. And then the other one, and I think this is probably where we are right now. You say, you write, never get bold when trades are running cold.
Yeah. And that would probably be very apropos to right now where, you know, or, you know, you have to gauge your own trading. Some people might be doing great right now. If you're a volatility trader and, you know, maybe you're doing great right now, but basically the general rule is that when things are going good, you know, I'm pressing the gas, and when they're not, I'm pulling back and I'm getting conservative and moving to cash. And unfortunately, that's a lot of people do just the opposite. When they're not doing well, they try to play catch up. They revenge trade. They try to get it back quickly, and they end up, you know, they double up and they end up getting themselves in a lot of trouble. But the goal is, if you want to trade and you want to be in the bull markets and out of the bear markets, the goal is to have a system that allows you to be trading the largest when you're trading your best and the smallest when you're trading your worst. And the only way to do that is to bend with the environment and move to cash when things aren't working, and move and have the discipline to get aggressive when they are.
You know, we mentioned briefly the Fed and some of the concerns about tapering, which seem to be, you know, depending on the day, top of mind or not. As we're talking now, Senator Elizabeth Warren is scheduled to be giving a speech about the recent revelations about, I'll call them insider trading, or some of the trades by some Fed presidents and the vice chair. Is that a market concern of yours? Or do you think, is this the price dictates news kind of situation where there's a lot of negative headlines out there and the market's going down, so people are looking for a reason why the market's going down instead of reverse engineering it?
Yeah, that would have no effect long-term whatsoever. In the short term, it could create some short-term volatility and a news headline, but no, that wouldn't have any effect whatsoever or any effect on my decisions.
And would you say the same about the debt ceiling debate, which continues to go on in Congress?
Well, you know, the debt ceiling, the debt is not as ominous as one would think. But again, it's certainly something that we'd be better off getting under control. But, you know, this market is being, you know, the easy money and the Fed being so accommodative is certainly, you know, pushing this market higher and higher and creating no other place to go, I guess. So, you know, bottom line is, though, you know, we're going to see if what the price is ultimately. This is why we have, every now and then you have stock market meltdowns and you have bear markets to correct out this excess.
I just wanted to quickly go back to the your poker analogy as someone who probably played a little too much at one point in my life.
Me too.
So it's easy to define one side of that trade, right? I'm putting $50 into a $500 pot, right? That's yep. It, whatever, 10 to 1 path. How do you define the other end of that? If I put $50 into a $500 pot and I've only got a 1 in 20 chance of winning that pot, that's not a good bet. How do you define the odds of winning that pot?
Yeah. So bottom line is you got to use your own results, because there's no absolutes here. You know, and there's no absolutes in poker either. Although, you know, there is the math behind it, and you absolutely know that over time, you know, aces are going to win X amount of time. Well, that's the real trick as far as getting a handle on what you can expect on the upside and mm-hmm. how often you can expect that. So if you can get a good idea of that, you know, on average, I'm going to make 10% per trade and I'm going to be right 50% of the time, well, now the loss side becomes a mathematical equation. So I'm always trying to get a handle on that profit side and what percentage I can expect over time. So that's really, you know, analyzing your own numbers, and you have to use what we call a result-based assumption. There's a theoretical-based assumption and there's a result-based assumption. I use result-based assumptions as opposed to guessing where I might be. I'm actually using my actual results. And as those results change, then I shift my, you know, my risk.
All right, Mark, I appreciate your time as always. And before I let you go, you said something about there's no other place to go. And it reminded me, I wanted to ask you about cryptocurrencies, if you have a view on them, because Bitcoin has been ripping. It's back above 50,000 as we're talking here today. I have been, and I've said it here on this podcast, with the mindset that it's, quote, just another, quote unquote, risk asset. And it had been running pretty much in tight correlation with the S&P 500. That has changed in the last week or so. Hey, do you trade cryptocurrencies? Do you have a thought on them as a hedge, or how do you view them?
Well, I mean, I view them as a very speculative, you know, asset that has had, you know, tremendous run. And I'd probably defer to my friend Lou Kerner, who some of you may know. He's an authority in that area and knows a lot about crypto. He's been involved in the crypto market for a long time and is very bullish on crypto in general. Again, you know, this is something that you could very easily have, you know, a big correction there. We've seen, you know, Bitcoin come in on big moves on the downside. Long term, I think that I have to be bullish on crypto. But you know, it's probably going to consolidate, and I'm sure there's still a lot of unknowns and also a lot of opportunity going forward. So I'm not big in crypto as far as I don't have any big positions in crypto. And, I don't know how I'm going to position myself going forward. We'll have to see, but I'm more interested in individual stocks myself.
All right. Whether it's individual stocks or crypto, we'd love to have you back in the near future to talk more about this. Our guest has been Mark Minervini. He's the author of several books, founder of Minervini Private Access. Mark, thanks again for being with us.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it. It was fun.
Thanks, Mark.
Welcome back to Alpha Trader. We are joined now by Dan David. He is the founder of Wolfpack Research, a short-based activist research firm, and the co-founder of Geo Investing LLC. Dan was featured as one of the lead protagonists in the 2018 documentary, The China Hustle, which documents his work and others exposing fraud in China-based U.S.-listed companies. Dan, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me. And shout out to Seeking Alpha too, because they're kind of an unsung character in the China Hustle.
That is true. I think so. That the movie goes back to almost a decade or so ago when you and Carson Block and some other folks sort of started going public with your concerns that some of the stocks being listed in U.S. exchanges coming out of China were outright frauds. And the movie, The China Hustle, goes into great detail about this. I don't want to spend too much time with the past because I'm curious to know your thoughts on what's happening today and here and now. But the thing that knocked me over in that movie was to learn that, at least at the time in China, it was legal for Chinese nationals to defraud foreigners. Is that still the case? It's still the case. Okay.
That is still the case. That is the progress that we've made. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, that's amazing to me. So does that suggest that foreign investors in Chinese stocks, whether they're listed here or not, should not believe the financials of these companies?
They should not. On a wholesale basis, even going up to Alibaba and Baidu, some of the bigger companies. I mean, you look at Alibaba, they have thousands of subsidiaries. Many of which don't do anything, but it keeps you from, so you have to pull these filings in China. They're called SAIC filings. There's other corporate filings that can be pulled as well, credit reports. And it becomes this monumentally onerous task to reverse engineer their financial filings. Now, I can do that for Google. I can do it for Amazon. I can do it for Apple. But you can't do it for Alibaba. Or any of those bigger companies. And it really is by design.
Interesting. Now, I am curious your thoughts on, Alibaba and Tencent, some of the other big Chinese listed companies. Yeah. This year have struggled largely with what's going on from China's regulators.
Yeah.
Is that a smokescreen? Is that something, was that something you would have expected 10 years ago or 5 years ago even, that might be the biggest risk if you're along those stocks?
We've said it. Thou shalt not be bigger than the state. That is a kind of a communist party, cast in cement. They're largely a non-religious state, right? And communism is in general because they don't even want God to be above the state. And then you start getting these cult of personalities like a Jack Ma,
right,
or companies that have so much financial or social influence that they become a threat to the state itself. And this is their crackdown on that. And they are not messing around. You can see they put Jack Ma in his gilded cage for a couple of months.
Yep. Yep.
And that's what they do to him. What they do to a normal citizen is less than gilded. It's more like an actual cage.
Right. Right. And I know you don't say that ingest. That's for real.
No, I've had my investigators arrested, jailed. They're not allowed to speak to anybody for months on end. It's not unusual, during this whole time period you're talking about, the China Hustle, and I guess when I say that, I mean the past 10 years, where a China-based CEO just disappears. And when that first happened, or I knew of that happening maybe 10 years ago, it kind of shocked me, but it didn't shock anybody in China. They're like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, state security must have them. Nobody's going to fill out a missing persons report or anything like that. They know they've been picked up and you won't hear from him or her for months.
Right. And again, you know, this is going back, the movie goes back to some of the stocks you were focusing on a decade or so ago, names like LNL Energy, Sinoclean, China Integrated Energy, China Agriculture, Puda Coal. And in the years around 2010, I guess it was, there were around 300 reverse mergers that brought all these Chinese companies to U.S. exchanges. The market cap estimates between $20 and $50 billion. Hey, how many of those companies from that era are still listed, actively traded stocks, or have you moved on to a whole new group of names?
Yeah, even if they are listed, any of the companies that you've mentioned that we went after, nobody survived that we'd gone after. I mean, it's true. I mean, a couple of them were 2 or 3 year running gun battles with, you know, LNL Energy or China Green Agriculture, this, you know, real knockdown, drag out fights. And then, of course, there's always a lawyer here. Mm-hmm. they're for sale, and the lawsuits break out. But eventually, they've all gone to nothing. Even if they trade on the bulletin boards, they're not worth anything. And they become SPACs. They became Jobs Act IPOs, which, what a great title for a way of listing frauds, right?
Jobs Act. Yeah.
That was some really good messaging, but you know, we couldn't get single payer healthcare because everybody thought they were the single payer.
Right. So that reminds me, one of the other things that watching the movie, and I just watched in the last 24 hours, again, it's called The China Hustle. I had that thought because a lot of those companies, many of them, if not most of them, came public through reverse mergers of U.S. companies that were still listed, but had basically ceased operating, old mining companies, things like that. And I thought, are SPACs the new China Hustle? Because they're also coming public through reverse mergers. Have you looked into the SPACs at all? Do you see similarities there?
I did a SPAC conference via satellite for Hong Kong about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. I used to go to Hong Kong in person, not anymore. Mm-hmm. For obvious reasons. There were, I want to say, 400 or 500 companies at this conference that were lined up to be a SPAC from China, because why not? I mean, with a SPAC, you don't even have the safe harbor problem, right? You can just do what they've done when they did have it. They just talk about how their TAM, you know, if they make shoes, their TAM is, I don't know, 10 billion, everybody with 2 feet, and just ridiculous. and they get
so
away.
So, TAM, total accessible market, sorry, for those not familiar. And you mentioned safe harbor provisions. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, basically in an IPO, you've got to have, you know, financial forecasts that are grounded in reality and will be looked at by the SEC. As you know, something that you'll be held accountable for if there are lies, misstatements, exaggerations. They don't basically let you say things like, you know, hey, we didn't have any revenue last year, but we're going to be a $190 billion company this year because we're going to get these three customers that have these letters of intent to work with us, that kind of a thing. But with a SPAC, you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And
it's asked Lordstown Motors.
Right.
What would you say to China bulls? You were talking about how Alibaba got too big and it gets taken down a notch or a number of notches by Beijing, and that's just the way things go there. But what would you say to China bulls? Say, hey, that kind of thing happens in the U.S. as well. I mean, Facebook, you know, is constantly the subject of being berated by U.S. senators or high administration officials. They're talking about Facebook in front of Congress today, and Elizabeth Warren wants it broken up. Jeff Bezos is under attack for not paying taxes. Are we just talking different level of degree here? Or, I mean, U.S. is a tough place to do business too once you get really big.
Well, I mean, it's a bit of apples and oranges. Look, with China, back to what you guys were saying to begin with, it's not illegal to lie, cheat, and steal from foreign investors. Arguably, it is illegal to do that if you're a U.S.-based company. Now, we all know that's just a fine. It's probably in the budget of Wells Fargo or, you know, BAML or whoever else that commits fraud on any given day. But it's supposed to be. It's not illegal there. You know, and Facebook's problems are well earned. They probably should be held accountable for some of the algorithms that they're running and lying about, and the chicanery that they're putting forward. I think the difference that you can see between how we're handling it, for better or worse, in China is China, you know, acts as, you know, judge, jury, and executioner, right, with their social platforms. Okay, yeah. Now kids can only be on the internet playing games 4 hours a week, period. Edict passed, no debate. I don't know that that's good or bad. I think that the addiction to some of the social platforms is bad for our youth, but, you know, I'm really more of one that believes in freedom, freedom of speech, and freedom to raise your children the way you see fit. That hasn't worked out so well for a lot of our kids, but social pressure should help with that, not legislation. And my biggest concerns with Facebook's and some of the others are the anti-competitive acts that they've taken over the past 10 years. Anybody that gets even close to competing with them on any level, they just buy them.
Mm. Right, or tweak their algorithm to directly go after them.
Well, that's Google. Yeah.
And I just want to be clear. My understanding is that you don't typically short these mega cap type companies. Is that right? Or do you have any positions vis-a-vis Alibaba, Facebook, or other names we've talked about so far?
Well, since a micro cap's now $10 billion market cap, I mean, we're that's kind of a sweet spot for us these days, is maybe 10 plus billion. But yeah, I mean, to your point, you're right. You start to get into, you know, hundreds of billions or half a $1 trillion company. It's very, very hard to go after a company like that, because even if you're pointing out fraud, you've got some analyst that comes on and says, well, even if this is fraud, it's this much of the business, so we'll give them this much of a haircut on their price, and that's going to be the fine, and they move on, right? So nobody really goes to jail for it here either. It's not that we're, you know, we have a better system. We don't use it.
Right.
That, you know, fraud is something that the middle class and the poor are for, and that the elites do not. And that's causing a pretty big social problem in our country, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. You had a great line that in the investment banking business, quote, fraud is baked into the income statement.
Yeah. Tell me it's not.
No, I believe it is. I mean, you know, you mentioned Wells Fargo, Bank of America. I mean, look at all the fines that JP Morgan has paid over the years for a variety of things, the London Whale, and they were doing business in the Sudan, I believe, you know, 10 plus years ago or something. And so they pay a fine and they move on. And on all the big banks, they paid fines after the 2008 financial crisis. Nobody went to jail. Well, sure, there were haircuts for the bondholders and stockholders, but those firms are still with us, bigger than ever.
Wells Fargo is ripping off its own customers.
Right.
And had to pay a $250 million fine, which ironically is a fine on its own customers and investors.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just like a circular kind of screwing that happens when these things come to light. And nobody there went to jail, right? I mean, I think somebody got their bonus clawed back. And to me, the biggest problem we have in our mega cap companies, and really any of them, is a complete lack of governance from the independent board of directors. It's an oxymoron to even say independent board of director.
Right.
There's no such thing. And they're supposed to notionally represent the shareholders' interest, but they don't.
Right. I didn't plan to go here, but you're reminding me again, in the movie China Hustle, retired General Wesley Clark has a bit part. He was the chair of Robinhood Renshaw, which was one of the investment banks that brought a lot of those Chinese companies public. And I believe at the end, they said he's been, and this was movie came out in 2018, on 18 public boards since then, since Robinhood Renshaw went into bankruptcy and came back out and all that. And he's no longer with them. But I guess that basically speaks to your point that it's a circular, it's a cycle of fraud. Actually, I don't know.
He was actually part of management. And, you know, just my take on General Clark, I don't think he was part of fraud. I think he was a figurehead. Right. They used his name and he knew it. I think when he became aware, my problem with him is that when he became aware of fraud or that the ship was sinking, he just jumped off. And if you're going to run around and tell everybody you're the supreme allied commander of NATO and you've got medals that cover your entire body, then be that guy that goes to Congress and says, this is what's going on. And I have some knowledge from the inside. You know, let's help go at, I mean, this is a former presidential candidate.
Right. He could have been a whistleblower is what you're saying.
Right. You should have seen, like, you know, how they were looking at me in 2012. I mean, you know, it's a totally different dynamic today where, you know, I can have an open dialogue with members of Congress or the SEC, which is good. You know, they call me and there's a level of respect there that wasn't there 10 years ago where it was hard to get anybody on the phone. It doesn't mean a whole lot has changed though. And I think,
right. Let's bring it to the present. And again, I recommend our listeners, if you haven't, to watch the movie and learn more about all this. But as we're sitting here today, late 2021, it seems the one thing that Democrats and Republicans agree on is that China represents, you know, our greatest threat, enemy, and a lot of, you know, we're facing an economic battle with them. Catherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative, has been out in the last 24 hours with some strong statements about how, you know, we're going to readjust our approach to them. Has anything changed? Do you feel any that your work in any part has helped move the needle in terms of how the U.S. government is approaching China?
Well, I mean, the China hustle is in the ethos now. I mean, and almost any legislation that comes out, whether it's the Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act or some of the others that have been put forth, are based and rooted in the China hustle. They say that. So, you know, I'm proud of the work that they did, that a lot of people did, getting that in the consciousness. Certainly a lot of people who should have are more worthy to be in that movie than me did a lot of work for it too. So I think we as people, the people, did something that China couldn't do, that people in China couldn't do. We exercised our free speech and our rights, and it was at great risk. I mean, I remember the first lawsuit that came my way was, you know, in 2011 for $249 million. And I don't care how tough you think you are, when you get that complaint, it's a bit of a pucker up moment. It's not a fun read. Financial terrorist, RICO, whatever. You know, I have parents that can read. It's a tough thing to see. And you talk to your lawyer and, you know, they're represented by, you know, white shoe legal firms that know these companies are frauds, but they take the fees anyway. I remember my first attorney was like, oh, yeah, well, what do you think you could settle for? I'm like, what? $1 million? He's like, yeah, how short would you be? And I'm like, yeah, $250 million. You better get your fucking word.
I was wondering if you could shed some light on another subject, given your insight into China, and that's Bitcoin. The Chinese government, as you know, early summer, basically crashed the price of Bitcoin, nearly killed it, in my opinion, by announcing a mining ban, and they've come out with further restrictions since. Do you think we could take that as face value? Is there energy shortages there? Bitcoin mining uses a lot of energy, and they just wanted to preserve energy elsewhere, or are they really going to try to ban that crypto from usage in the country?
Bitcoin, the banning of Bitcoin in China is about control. Bitcoin is an uncontrollable currency, if you want to look at it that way. And China has and always will control its currency. So they'll come out with their own digital currency that they control, but they're not going to let the yuan float. Right. They're not going to let some kind of currency come in and allow their population and their people to have, you know, money off the books. They want to know where it all is. So that would, I mean, I've always known they were going to ban Bitcoin. It's what are we going to do? And how are we going to handle it? I don't know.
Right.
It seems like it's here to stay.
Remains to be seen. And we touched on this in the first half of the show with Mark Minervini. He's not a big crypto trader either, but this idea that Bitcoin has been going up in the last week to 10 days as the market, the S&P 500 particularly, has been heading down is different than what we've seen most of the last year plus. Is there, do you think, or am I being too conspiratorial, some connection between that and what's going on with Evergrande and Fantasia, that you have Chinese nationals who are like, the blank's about to hit the fan here. I want to get my money out of China, and Bitcoin's a way to do it.
Well, there are a lot of reasons why people might think that Bitcoin has really risen in value in the last couple of years. My view is it's a lack of trust in our government and the debt. You start to think about $30 trillion in debt. It's a massive amount of money, just in a physical form. $7 trillion will stack on top of each other, will take you to the moon and back. We owe $30 trillion to ourselves. For all of you that think that, oh, okay, we just won't pay back China, we don't owe China $30 trillion. We owe ourselves 90% of that. The Fed, unfunded pensions and liabilities, things of this, that's who doesn't get paid back, your retirement. So it has to get paid back. And then interest rates have to remain low, right? Because at 3% interest on $30 trillion, we're paying $900 billion in interest, which is more than we pay for our military every year. It makes no sense. And Bitcoin, I think people are seeing, is a hedge on inflation. It's a hedge on the US dollar, which really is valued in what? Faith?
Well, it's backed by the U.S. Armed Forces is how I look at it. So we spend a lot of money
backed by the military. Well, yeah. Good luck to them in the South China Sea, Aaron, because China has denial of access there now without a catastrophic loss of life.
Absolutely. And again, we talk about geopolitics and largely as it may affect some markets. But in the last couple of days, China has invaded Taiwan's airspace more than once. It's like 70 sorties plus. Taiwan says they are preparing for war, and they should. So again, is that in the markets? Clearly not. War between China and Taiwan is not in the market. Is that why the market's been weakening? It's so hard to know. Is it the debt ceiling debate? Is it Jay Powell's in the crosshairs, the tapering, just the fact that it's September, October, the debt you just mentioned, but China invading Taiwan, that's serious. That's
I will give you a direct link to the market where this is concerned. And one, with our trade representatives going over there and talking tough, notice the actual actions were, A, they've broken the deal and we haven't called them on it. And right now we've given them loopholes on the deal. So you can say whatever you want, but you've got to watch the actual actions. I mean, Trump was an absolute disaster every time he opened his mouth, but the actions were really putting pressure on China, especially when he would go over there, his representatives would go over there and say, good meeting, fantastic, we all agree. Come back to the United States and say, we don't agree on anything. That drove them crazy. Mm-hmm. They needed stability. And we need a little more of that in this administration without the rancor that was caused in the last. But the direct effect in the market you can see is China is going to invade Taiwan in some way, shape or form. Hopefully it's not going to be a physical invasion and a kinetic conflict. I think it probably will be. But President Xi, for everything you can say about this man, he says what he's going to do and then he does it.
Right.
Every single time. And he said out loud, we will invade Taiwan. And we're not going to stop them, by the way, because we're not going to go lose aircraft carriers with 5,000 sailors to stop an invasion of Taiwan. It'll be terrible, much worse than Hong Kong. And hopefully there will be a real, real political price for them to pay. But I don't think we can stop them. Now, imagine what happens to Alibaba's stock price, Baidu, and all the rest of these companies that are listed on foreign exchanges when and if that happens. So what they've done is they've dual listed in Hong Kong. And what President Xi has said over the last 6 months or a year, even with the Didi action of them pulling their IPO here in the United States, or IPOing here in the United States and China coming out the next day saying, your business
doesn't exist. Yeah.
They're pulling all their companies back to their home market. They're pulling them back to Hong Kong. They're pulling back to China because they really can't have their biggest companies solely exposed to foreign markets when such a conflict is, if not inevitable, likely.
Interesting. But again, you're not shorting the Alibabas of the world or Tencent,
etc. Well, my business model has always been hyper specific, Aaron. I'm not a macro short. You know, I leave that to Chanos. If I think I can be better than him, then I'm, you know, out of business. Nobody is. And he doesn't make money every year.
No, right. Exactly. Yeah. He's been warning about China for a while and it hasn't come to pass maybe the way he would expect it or the timing on the time frame he would have expected. So then that's a good segue, I think, to talk about some of the specific names you have published research on.
And just to be clear, like I don't play with my computer every day trading in and out of stocks. I spend my time micro focusing on a company and finding fraud, material misrepresentation, and I go at them hard with a big percentage of my portfolio, one at a time, generally, and that's the activist shorting model. Is to be loud and detailed in my research on one or two companies at a time, not to have a portfolio of 10 or 15 companies that I hope Mr. Market's not going to like at the same time I don't like them.
Got it. So the most recent one you published on is SGOC is the symbol, yeah. SGOCO Group.
Yeah.
And since you published, the stock was around $20 in mid-July. You made the short call in mid-August. Now it's trading around $6. A, are you still shorted? And B, you know, what is it about this company that prompted you to come out so aggressively against them?
Well, it is my opinion that they're committing fraud, as I stated in my report. And you know, they don't own the assets they say they do. And our short calls for the year on four of the companies that we published on this year are down an average of over 50%. Same thing with Moxie, same thing with an American company called Skills. So that is basically what I go after. And I think that, you know, with these China-based companies, it's very, very tough. I mean, with Skills, look, I felt like they're a SPAC that was over-aggressive, like almost all these SPACs are, about their future prospects and how they're going to do. And you just pull up App Annie or something and something of that sort. That's not what we used. And it shows that their two biggest customers that were a huge percentage of their business are in decline. And that's how you get there. But with Moxie and with Skills and the other China-based companies, I mean, we're proving fraud in my opinion. And nobody's arguing it. I mean, you just look for the rebuttal on those two companies. They're not there. They're not even rebutting it. It just continues to trade. And it's a manipulation, just like they did with GSX last year, which I think they, funny, GSX changed their ticker symbol to GOTU, got you. Very funny.
Right.
Because they did.
Right.
You know, we're short them at 30 bucks. We didn't put out a report, but I thought the research that that Muddy Waters and others had done was just phenomenally detailed and correct. And you've got that Bill Huang guy that just gunned it and got it up to 140 bucks a share. That was a tough squeeze to be a part of.
I'm sure. But you're still short those names currently? Yeah. Or you know, how do you manage those positions? I guess, is, you know, more broadly speaking, at what point do you say, okay, I've made my profit here and I'm out?
I manage them very well when I'm making money and poorly when I'm not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah.
I'm familiar with that. Look, when you're short, you are looking at that screen at all times, or somebody is that you trust. And you do have to manage risk. And it's just really, really painful. But hey, you know, when GSX is at 60 or 70 or 80 bucks and your average price is 38 or 40. You've got to take risk off at a loss because it can't be that much of your portfolio. And of course, shorting, unlike investing, your losses are potentially unlimited.
Right. I mean, theoretically, stock can go to infinity, right? I can only go down as low as zero. Yes.
Yeah.
And when they do go your way, do you have, you know, how do you define when and where to take your profit?
Well, I'll de-risk. I mean, I had a stock this last year that was down over 50% in 3 hours. You know, and do I have my full position? Do I still have my full position? No, I do not. the exchanges aren't halting anymore for investigations of fraud. They're just for-profit companies that work as quasi, you know, government entities that are protected from lawsuits, which is another problem. And they just let it go. It doesn't really make any sense anymore to ride something down to zero. I mean, I knew people back when you were talking about the reverse merger days. People would never cover, never. Why? Why deal with the tax implication if you've got a big hedge fund? Like, people in 2015 owned LNL Energy at one penny, or shorted at one penny, and just never covered. You can't do that anymore. You've got to de-risk. Otherwise, you're going to get blown up like some people did in Got You or GSX, whatever you want to call it.
And I would say during the whole the Wall Street Bets, seems like a million years ago, but I guess it was only about 6 months ago.
I was never, I mean, I commented on that. I guess the networks, whatever, CNBC and others, they're fantastic valuations. They were good. I mean, GameStop was a good short at $20. It really was, fundamentally speaking. And before they raised money, which they had every right to do, since it's gone up so much. But you can't fight the tide. Your short thesis is only right if the rest of the market agrees with you when you're short. And if they don't, this is what happens. And for those of people that think that, you know, the people on the Reddit boards are just unsophisticated, investors that don't know what they're doing, maybe some of them, but not the leaders in this. They knew that the short squeeze was set up. They knew that between, you look at Vanguard, Fidelity, BlackRock, all of these passive investing vehicles do not buy or sell on price. They buy or sell on inflows and outflows of money. So they weren't selling or buying GameStop at $20, and they weren't selling it at $250 either. That's the problem. So when you had 80% of the float taken up by insiders and passive investment vehicles, I think I did the math at one point in the very beginning of this, there were really only 4 million shares trading. None of these others were trading. They were, out of 80 million shares, it was all basically locked up by passive investors and insiders. And that's what they realized on the message boards.
Yeah, the gamma squeeze. So did you, I should ask, did you have any positions in GameStop or AMC or the other so-called meme stops, stocks?
No, never long, never short.
Okay.
Stayed away.
Which leads me to in a backhanded way, to this idea that the short sellers, it's a cabal. That's always the word that's used, which, you know, to me, I get a vision of dark hoods, around a fire at night, maybe there's some satanic rituals going on and we're a podcast, but we're on video here. He's got a black hoodie and he's putting it on. And except for the smile, it looks like
part. On, you can have a sinister smile too, right?
That's right. Yeah, you can, but you're, I see you're laughing. Your eyes are laughing. What do you say to do you even care anymore? Like, what do you say to people who might be listening to this podcast who think that short sellers by definition are evil actors in the market?
Do I care anymore? No. I don't think anybody believes that short sellers are really, truly, a serious person wouldn't believe that evil actors in the market. I think that there is kind of this, I say ignorant in the clinical term of ignorance, belief that there might be some kind of cabal or cartel, or which is completely against the technicals of how it works, number one. Two, we all hate each other. I mean, like, I don't like five short sellers. I mean, Carson and I are very good friends. Soren and I are very good friends. But, for the most part, you've got to be kind of screwed up in the head to be a short seller. You know, I fell into it. I was along.
Right.
What do I say to these China bulls? I think Stephen had asked me earlier in this show. I would say I was one of you, and I just got sick of being lied to, and went and did my own research and hired my own team to go to China. I hired a team to go check out 30 companies in China to prove Carson Block was lying and overstating the problem. And they came back and said, well, he is wrong. He's understating the problem. It's fraud is out there. It's pervasive. Who's going to expose these frauds? Is it going to be investment bank analysts who have never done it ever? Who are 9 to 1 buys to sells, even going into any financial crisis, including now?
Right. I'm thinking of Enron. They were all had strong buy ratings on Enron up until the last day.
Or Lehman, or Bear Stearns, or any of the rest. I mean, and is it going to be the investigative reporter that no longer exists? Who do we have left? Bill Alpert and Roddy Boyd? I mean, the risk of litigation really kind of took all that off the table for most of these papers, and the amount of massive work that gets involved for, you know, a couple of news cycles and then inevitable litigation. So it was those two vacuums, right? The joke that there is an independent, the investment bank analysts were independent from the banking side, right? There's this Chinese firewall. Man, there's not even a fern between them, not even a potted plant. Okay. You get it. You put in a sell on a company, they're not doing business at the bank anymore. Everybody knows it. And then the investigative reporters not reporting it. So that created that vacuum for us, which it was a very scary thing at the time. I'll tell you, Aaron, because we didn't know how the SEC or how the DOJ or how anybody was going to view us 10 or 12 years ago when we just started publishing our work with a vested interest. It was kind of trial and error, right? What's going to happen here?
Right. And here we are 10, 12 years later. And has something's changed, right? You mentioned earlier the China hustle's in the zeitgeist, and you know Congress at least has an awareness of the financial or economic threat that China poses. But it sounds like you think the fraud is still there writ large.
Fraud is still there. I mean, take China out of the equation; it's still there in the U.S. markets with U.S. companies. I mean, short sellers were very angry with me 10 years ago when I went to Congress to try and educate on this problem. Actually, I thought I would just tell them what the problem was and they'd fix it. I didn't really realize that they had no idea how to fix it themselves and they would ask me for advice. It was like, oh, okay. What do you want me to do? I came to my congressman. I mean, that's what I did. I mean, then I came back the next year with solutions. One of which was just to maybe tag these companies with an asterisk or a dropdown that says, here are some additional risks that you need to know about, but they wouldn't even do that. You know, fraud's pervasive in our markets all over the place, Aaron. It's going to continue to be. If you take China out of the equation, I'll still be doing what I do because it's available to do that, right? I mean, nobody's going to jail for this shit anymore. So, excuse my language, but it's somebody has to tell the truth in investing, and it's certainly not going to be investment banks.
All right, on that note, we do have to leave it there. Our guest has been Dan David. He's the founder of Wolfpack Research and a podcast of the same name and co-founder of Geo Investing. Dan, thanks so much for being here.
I would say this, my podcast is actually called I Hung Up on Warren Buffett.
Oh, I'm sorry, I Hung Up on Warren Buffett. Thank you for clarifying. As I said it, I was like, that's not right. I Hung Up on Warren Buffett is the podcast. Wolfpack Research is the firm, and Dan David is the man behind it all. Dan, thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
Be well, gentlemen.